Tales from Nun's Bottom, Episode 3, Mrs. Ortega Goes Home. The time Mrs. Ortega went back to Argentina would be remembered by many at Nun's Bottom for years to come. As it happens, the story had a happy ending, but that's the ending and I've no business talking about it at the beginning. So this is what happened. Since Daniel Ortega had bought Allsop and Tite, the company had blossomed. Whether that was because Daniel had some magical touch or because the previous owner, Graham Tite, was lazy, inept, bad at business and frankly rude to people, which didn't help sales, I guess on reflection it was probably the latter. But the main difference was that Graham had never been able to see beyond hearses, whereas Daniel had looked at the business, at its assets and strengths, and assessed where he could best use those assets and strengths elsewhere, given that the hearse fitting business is, as you probably realise, somewhat limited in scope. That was why he diversified and started fitting out limousines, and that was how he came to have a highly specified armoured Range Rover kind of left over from a job for some Arab sheikh. Old Harry wasn't keen at first. He had never known anything but hearses since he had come to work for Frederick Allsop all those years ago. Daniel was sympathetic, which was all you could be towards Harry because he was so old you felt anything less would be unkind. Jimmy Musgrave, on the other hand, restricted his comments to a strong hint that he should get a pay rise. Well, they should all get a pay rise, but him especially, what with him being a supervisor now. To which Daniel said no. Well, just no, actually, without any explanation. Why should he explain the economics of Allsop and Tite to Jimmy Musgrave? Daniel didn't know much about the British way of doing business, but even in Argentina, they had the mushroom principle of employment. In case you've had a sheltered life, that means keeping your staff in the dark and occasionally shovelling manure on them. And he applied that to Jimmy on the basis that Jimmy was a loud-mouthed lout and fully deserving of such treatment. Pat Donoghue, on the other hand, he treated quite differently. She was a skilled craftsman, which in fairness Jimmy was too, but Pat was quite unlike Jimmy and Daniel didn't find it hard to be nice to her, whereas being nice to Jimmy would have been a waste of time. The only time Daniel was nice to him was when he needed to butter him up, which he also didn't find difficult because being nice to someone for business purposes isn't like being nice to them because you like them or anything like that. Pat Donoghue was everything Jimmy wasn't, which, in a nutshell, was a good employee. When you employ people, they're never quite what you wanted or expected. They don't see the things the way you do, and they think they should give you the benefit of their advice, which you don't actually want because you're the boss, thank you very much. And they sulk if they don't get things their own way, and they go off sick when they're not sick at all, or they might be just a little bit sick and they fancy a rest, something you as the employer don't ever get. And they let you down, and they don't do what you tell them to, or they don't understand what you want them to do, but they don't tell you they don't understand, so you go off thinking they're doing it, and when you get back, they haven't started, because they've been waiting for you to come back and explain it all over again. And then, just when you get completely fed up and wonder how you can fire them, they come and ask you for a rise. No, being the boss is no fun. Pat didn't give him any of this kind of trouble, though, and the less trouble she gave him, the more Jimmy resented it. Jimmy couldn't help being what he was, but he was so completely insensitive that he couldn't see that Pat was looked upon more favourably than he was. He put it down at first to sexism, what with Daniel being a foreigner and foreigners not knowing how things are done here, i.e. women in the workplace aren't looked upon favourably, let alone women doing men's work, which is what carpentering was, which was Pat's trade and shouldn't be, what with her being a woman. That's what he thought, and it's what he said to old Harry more than once, in fact, more than that even, until even old Harry got fed up hearing it. He had never much liked Jimmy, but it wasn't until Pat brought an aura of civilization to the place that he realised quite how much he didn't like him. Now, Jimmy's voice started to grate on his nerves, and if the younger man said once more about women at work, he felt sure he would, despite the difference in their age, feel the need to lay about him. Anyway, while all this was going on, Daniel was taking orders for limousines and the work was coming in nicely. He found the armoured Range Rover helpful when it came to selling because it incorporated some of Allsop and Tait's finest work. Despite being the weight of a Sherman tank, once you closed the doors with the reassuring clunk, you were surrounded by opulence and luxury. Behind the bulletproof glass and Jimmy's reinforced mine-proof door, it was all thick carpeting, walnut veneer and sumptuous seating. Old Harry said it was like being in one of those fancy coffins with all the satin and padding and fine wood and brass handles, which Daniel thought an unfortunate analogy, but he took the point. Mrs. Ortega, by the way, thought it was ridiculous and made him look like some mafia boss. Daniel said that was silly, but nevertheless, he quite liked driving around looking like a mafia boss, so he was glad she said that. By the time one of their limousines was finished, it had more than doubled in weight, especially with the armour plating, and you needed a minimum of 4 litres to move the thing at any decent speed. Daniel's car consumed diesel at such a rate he couldn't drive more than 100 miles before he was looking for a filling station. But the sort of people he sold conversions to weren't bothered about things like running cost, more often than not because they owned their own oil wells, and in some cases, their own countries, and in one particular case, someone else's country. Daniel not infrequently had to make sales trips to see clients abroad. Some were far-flung places, and then he flew. But if he could put the Range Rover on the ferry and drive, then he did. And when he was asked to go and see Piet van der Meer, the wealthiest diamond dealer in Amsterdam, he naturally took the car. He left Jimmy nominally in charge, which meant finishing off a hearse for the cooperative funeral service and delivering it to Swansea, and checking in a pair of matching BMWs for the pop singer Ricky Budd and his latest wife, for whom they had been contracted to rip out the seats and put in black Persian lambskin upholstery. Daniel wanted the job finished quickly before Ricky had a chance to change his mind. Either that or he and his wife split up, which was a hazard when you were dealing with celebrities. Anyway, as I said, Jimmy was in charge as far as Jimmy was concerned, but in practice old Harry was there to keep an eye on things, and the only person who had Daniel's phone number in case of problems was Pat. With those arrangements made, he kissed his wife goodbye and set off for Dover. The trip to Amsterdam was pretty uneventful, apart from just some jobs worth at Hoek van Holland wanting to investigate the car as he drove it down the ramp. Daniel shrugged and let him get on with it. He was used to it by now, and anyway, he was in no hurry. Not being in a hurry was something he learned in Argentina, where if you tried to rush people in uniform, that was, they just made sure that whatever it was they were doing took twice as long. So he sat and waited while they went through the vehicle with a fine-tooth comb and found nothing. When he got to Jordan-Breestraat, it was almost closing time. Piet van der Meer welcomed him warmly, and in just half an hour they were back in the Range Rover heading out of the city for dinner at his house. Piet admired the car as Daniel drove, and by the time they got to the house he had decided it would have to be a Range Rover. Piet wasn't the sort of man to hang around, and before his wife had served dinner he had made Daniel an offer for the car. Daniel was tempted. His wife didn't like it, and it was, he had to admit, ridiculously expensive to run. He had never intended to use it in the first place. It was left-hand drive anyway, so it suited Dutch roads better than British ones. Yes, he thought he would sell it, but he would sleep on it and let Piet know in the morning. The next day, they went over the vehicle, and Piet showed Daniel the changes he would want, which first and foremost meant somewhere to carry diamonds worth anything up to £1 million. The idea of moving stones in a private car rather than an armoured van was discretion. There was no point advertising what you were doing. And by the same token, the best way to carry gems was to put them somewhere no one would think of looking. So they went over the vehicle inch by inch and examined every possible hiding place. Diamonds don't take up a lot of space, so they just needed some hidey hole that was completely inconspicuous. They looked at the armrests, but decided that was too easy. They examined the dashboard, but Daniel said anyone who managed to steal the vehicle would simply rip it out, so they dropped that idea. They thought about the external parts of the car, like the wheels, and Daniel even suggested a false fuel tank with a locking filler cap on the opposite side of the real one. But in the end, it was felt they should restrict themselves to the interior. Hiding a package of stones when the vehicle might be parked on the street would be too difficult to do without being seen. And then Daniel came up with the perfect solution. The only drawback was that it would be impossible on his car. They would need a later model for it to work. Pete shrugged his shoulders and said he would order one from the Dutch concessionaire and have it shipped over to Nonsbottom. They agreed a price for the work and shook hands before Daniel climbed back into his car, thought fleetingly about his wife, and headed for the port. 2 months later, Pete van der Meer arrived at Nonsbottom to take delivery of his new Range Rover. Daniel sent Jimmy up to London on an errand because Nonsbottom itself was scruffy enough for a wealthy diamond dealer without Jimmy making it look worse. Pat roped old Harry in to helping clean the place up, and by the time Pete arrived, it looked no worse than any other garage. Daniel showed Pete his new vehicle, and Pete whistled in appreciation at the work they had done. The seats were in the softest dove grey leather, with matching leather trim on the doors, the dash and the steering wheel. The carpet on the floor was the darkest crimson. Jimmy said if he did get done over, at least it wouldn't show the blood. And the bulletproof windows were tinted to match the jet black bodywork. From the outside, it looked much like Daniel's own car, and when he saw them together, Pete smiled. The real difference between the two cars was the steering column. Daniel showed him how to turn the indicator stalk to release the wheel, which slid down to reveal the column itself. This was then twisted anti-clockwise to open a cylindrical chamber large enough to hold upwards of £1 million worth of stones, if they were good ones, and Van der Meer diamonds only dealt in good ones. Pete tried the mechanism several times, and his smile got bigger each time Jimmy had done a good job, and Pete wanted to show him his appreciation. Daniel made the appropriate excuses about Jimmy and promised to pass on his thanks. Then Pete, Daniel, Pat and old Harry went out to the Muck Spreader's Arms for lunch, and Pete paid his bill to Allsop and Tite and said his goodbyes. And all in all, by the time Jimmy got back, they were feeling very mellow, and Jimmy wondered what he had missed and no one told him. But Daniel gave him the bottle of whisky Pete had bought for him at the pub, and that cheered him up no end. It was about a month later that Daniel saw it in the newspaper. Dutch diamond dealer in £1 million kidnap, it said. Daniel read it at the breakfast table while his wife was telling him something about her sister in Buenos Aires telephoning and she might have to go over because their father had taken a bad turn and wanted his daughters there. At least that was what she said, and I'm telling you because that's my job, but Daniel himself didn't hear her. Actually, these days, Daniel often didn't hear his wife, but today it was with good reason. The paper said that wealthy Amsterdam diamond dealer Pete van der Meer, the managing director of Van der Meer Diamonds, had been kidnapped at gunpoint driving from Madrid to Bordeaux in his armoured Range Rover. He had stopped to fill up at a petrol station outside San Sebastian, and before he could get back in the car, he had been bundled into a van and driven off at high speed. By the time the Guardia Civil arrived, all they found was the Range Rover with the driver's door wide open. The filling station staff, when questioned, were unable to provide any information about the attackers or their vehicle. One man said it was a white van, and another said it was red, and that's when the police knew it was pointless questioning them any further. They were either completely stupid or sympathisers. The police had already decided Pete had been kidnapped by Basque terrorists, and it was obviously pointless asking them any more questions. The police had moved the vehicle, but no one could start the engine. They realised it had an immobiliser and that they wouldn't be able to get past that. They scoured it for diamonds, but if Pete had been carrying any, the kidnappers had clearly got those because there was nothing to be found. So it was sitting in the police pound until someone came to claim it. Either Pete if he came out of this, or his heirs. It was 3 days later that Daniel was sitting in his office at Nunsbottom and the phone rang. And it was a call from Holland, from Jos Oudmayer, personal assistant to Mr. Piet van der Meer of Van der Meer Diamonds BV. Her English was impeccable, better even than Daniel's, and she came straight to the point. Her boss had been kidnapped. Daniel said, yes, he knew. And the kidnappers, who were indeed Basque separatists, had hoped to find diamonds on him because they knew he had been on a buying trip in Madrid. She didn't know how, but that was something they would be investigating. But they hadn't found anything in his briefcase other than some low-grade stones, and they knew he hadn't gone all that way just for those. Naturally, they hadn't had time to search the vehicle, and they couldn't get to it now because it was in the police pound. They seemed to know pretty well the value of the gems he had bought in Madrid, and they wanted them in return for which they would release him safely. Daniel, by this time, was ahead of her. If the diamonds were indeed in the car, he was the only person who would be able to find them. She had traced him through the invoice from Allsop and Tite for the conversion, and she was asking for his help. Piet van der Meer's life was in his hands. Van der Meer Diamond BV would pay whatever it took to secure that help. Daniel didn't even have to think about it. What an adventure. He was at their service. Actually, he had quite taken to Piet, and in a more serious moment, he thought this was the least he could do for a man he had started to think of as a friend. When he told his wife that, she said he was stark raving mad. She said it was nothing to do with him. The police would handle it. If some Dutchman was in trouble in Spain, it was of no concern to Daniel Ortega. He let her rant and rave, and he even for a moment thought she might be right. What was it to do with him? Well, not a lot perhaps, but a man's life was in his gift, and that made it his business whether he liked it or not, and frankly, whether she liked it or not. Yes, Piet was depending on him, and he wouldn't be able to live with himself if he refused a fellow man in his hour of need. Mrs. Ortega said, in Spanish now because she was angry, that he was an idiot talking like that, and did he think anyone would go and rescue him if he was kidnapped? To which Daniel said, quietly, in complete contrast to his wife's deluge, that he hoped so. Daniel loaded up the Range Rover with everything he could think he might need, because he didn't know how long he was going to be away. At Portsmouth, he drove on to the Pride of Bilbao, and then he had two days sailing, in which to catch up with some sleep and gather his thoughts. By the time the coast of Spain was coming into view, he had started to have doubts. Where was he even going to begin? What worried him most of all was not dealing with the Basque separatists, but the police. Was he supposed to drive up to the pound and say, "Excuse me, would you mind if I just get £1 million worth of diamonds from that car over there and give it to a bunch of terrorists?" How likely were they to say, "Oh, okay, just go ahead and good luck." Not very. All his worries, though, were dissipated when he drove off the ramp at Bilbao, and there was Jos Oudmayer. She wasn't alone either. With her was a man who, from his build, could only be there for one purpose. He was the cavalry. Daniel felt immediately reassured, and as they drove into the city, Jos outlined the plan to him. There was just one part she hadn't been able to work out, and that was getting into the police pound. Once they'd done that, the exchange with the terrorists wasn't expected to present any problems. Daniel didn't share her confidence on that score, but nevertheless, he was happy that she felt that way. The bodyguard, whose name Daniel hadn't quite caught but thought it sounded something like Dirk, sat in the back with his arms folded. And those arms were impressive. His muscles filled his shirt almost to bursting, and on one forearm there was a tattoo which, without wanting to appear nosy and look too close, seemed to Daniel to be a pair of wings, and he took Dirk to be ex-paratroops. His blonde hair was cropped short and his jaw was of that square-cut type you see in the films but don't think exists in reality, but you'd be wrong because that's just what he had. Yes, Daniel felt greatly comforted by Dirk's presence, although he did fleetingly consider just how much use all this muscle would be faced with a 9mm pistol, let alone a submachine gun. But perhaps Dirk was armed. He didn't feel it was something he could ask. Jos had gone quiet on the subject of getting into the pound, But as they reached the city centre, she asked Daniel to pull over, and she and Dirk got out and stepped back from the car and talked to each other quietly in Dutch. Daniel, of course, had no idea what they were saying, but he could tell it was a question and it concerned his Range Rover. Then she hit him with it. Daniel's car was exactly the same colour as Pete's. There was a chance, just a chance, mind you, that if they could get into the pound, they could swap the two cars. Yes, Daniel could see the possibility, but he was doubtful on the point of coming all this way and giving his car away, even for a friend. He was also doubtful about just how they were going to achieve this swap. Did she intend to break into the police pound? No, she didn't mean that. She would figure out a way. The next day, they left the hotel after breakfast and Jos asked Daniel to drive across town to the police pound. As they sat there, they could see Pete's car. It was on the far side, next to a large van, and they could only see the rear part, but there was no mistaking it. Jos seemed pleased with what she saw, and she asked Daniel to drive a couple of blocks away. She was very specific about where she wanted him to park, which he thought strange, but still he complied. Then she hailed a taxi, and they returned to the city centre, where she suggested they take a tourist bus and do a tour of the city. Daniel thought this odd, but he found her commanding manner reassuring, and he went along with whatever it was she was doing. She sat next to him on the bus, and Dirk sat immediately behind them, his brooding presence a permanent feature of the afternoon. They saw the whole city from one end to the other, and they had a good lunch at an expensive restaurant, and Jos paid for everything. She seemed to be quite relaxed, which worried Daniel. But each time he looked at Dirk, he too looked relaxed. Well, as relaxed as anyone with a jaw as rugged as that can look. So he settled down and enjoyed the rest of the day. Then they got a taxi back to where Daniel's car was parked. But instead of transferring to it, Jos told them to wait in the cab while she went and had a look. In the gloom, Daniel saw her looking at the windscreen, and he could see the disappointment on her face. She came back and got in next to him, and the driver took them back to the hotel. The next morning after breakfast, they took a taxi again, and this time, when she saw the windscreen of his car, she smiled. He got out and stood there, and what she was smiling at was a parking ticket. This was too much. How could the foolish woman be happy about a parking ticket? Well, she could pay for it because he wasn't going to. By now, he was beginning to tire of this game. But she told him to leave the ticket exactly where it was, and they got back in the cab and drove back to their hotel. There they had an early lunch, and this time they took a taxi out to the bridge that you just have to see if you go to Bilbao. It was built by Alexandre Gustave Eiffel, the man who built the tower, and it carries passengers in a cabin slung underneath across a great gorge with views for miles and miles. Actually, Jos and Daniel went. Dirk declined, and after they had left him behind, Jos explained Dirk was afraid of heights, which Daniel thought a bit odd for a parachutist, and he started to wonder whether there were wings on his arms at all. The view was, as expected, thrilling, and for a while Daniel felt like he was on holiday. He even thought how nice it would have been to have his wife with him. For a little while he forgot the seriousness of their mission. The next morning, they took a taxi yet again to the street where his car was parked, and when they got there, it wasn't. Parked, I mean. It was gone. Daniel stood and stared in horror at the space where it had been. What was there now was a beaten-up Renault, and he viewed the thing with disgust. Jos, however, was positively delighted, and before Daniel could say any more, she ushered him back into the cab and asked him to tell the driver, she didn't speak Spanish, to take them to the police station. There, as they looked through the chain-link fence in the pound, was Daniel's Range Rover, and there on the other side, still partially hidden by the van, was Pete's. Jos couldn't have been happier, and now for the first time, Daniel saw exactly what she has done, and now he too was smiling. This woman was smart. They went into the station and paid his fine and release fee, upon which a lazy officer opened the gate for him and told him to get his car. Jos slipped him Pete's spare key and without hesitation, Daniel strode over to the other man's Range Rover, got in, and drove out of the gate. Pete, if they succeeded, would collect Daniel's car for him later. Round the corner, he stopped the car, turned the indicator stalk, and slid the steering wheel down, revealing the column. This he deftly twisted anti-clockwise, and it slid open to reveal a package wrapped in a soft black cloth. Jos stayed his hand and instructed him to leave it where it was. This wasn't the place. It turned out that Daniel wasn't included in the next part of Jos's plan, and the next day he waited impatiently while she and Dirk went off with the diamonds. It was early evening when they walked through the hotel doors into the lobby, and with them, looking tired but happy, was Pete van der Meer. He put his arms round Daniel and lifted him clean off the floor, almost crushing him in his excitement. Daniel thought his arm was going to come off when Pete finally put him down and started to shake his hand in both of his. The next day, after a great deal of celebration, Pete went to the police pound and recovered Daniel's car. Then he made a speech in which he promised eternal friendship. Daniel had only to ask and he would be there for him. Then Jos gave him a hug and a kiss. Dirk slapped him on the back, which he could have done without, and the three of them got into Pete's Range Rover and headed for the motorway north. Daniel turned his own car towards the port, and 2 days later he drove off the ramp at Portsmouth. England suddenly felt like home. When he arrived back at the house, though, it was empty. There was no sign of his wife, but there was a note on the mantelpiece. It said, "I've gone back to Argentina. Your dinner's in Tesco." Had she left her husband? You'll be glad to know she hadn't. The day after Daniel left for Spain, she had had a call from Buenos Aires to say her father had taken a turn for the worse, and she'd gone straight to the airport and flown home with only time to leave Daniel that brief note. The story of Daniel's adventure in Spain was round the estate in no time, as was Mrs. Ortega's departure for Argentina, and somehow the two stories got connected. But in fact, they were nothing to do with each other.